You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 2nd to the 8th of April 2015. My name's Chris Parr, I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove, books editor Karen Shook and deputy features editor Paul Jump. This week's magazine is dominated by our annual HE Pay Survey, 11 pages of feature in total, plus a splash that focuses on the continuing gender pay gap in academia. More on that shortly. Another week, another three ref stories from Paul. This week we have news that the impact element of the 2014 Research Excellence Framework alone was almost as costly to institutions as the entire 2008 research assessment exercise. That and a couple of other genuinely interesting tidbits on REF in this week's magazine that Paul will tell us about shortly. And Karen is here, of course, with our regular books section roundup. But first, higher education pay. Always a controversial issue. Loads of analysis this week, but Jack, your lead news story chooses to focus this year on the gender pay gap. What's the story?
Well, every year, as part of our analysis of pay across the sector, we get information from the Higher Education Statistics Agency on the average pay at each institution, and this breaks down by gender. And according to this, you can see that female academics are paid around £5,700 less than male scholars. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a gender pay gap on all types of staff at all levels of seniority. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, the sort of gender pay gap has narrowed a bit since 10 years ago when it was about 14 or 15%, but it's still 11.3%, and that is worse in some parts of the country, like Scotland and Northern Ireland. And it's quite big money, actually, in terms of some institutions. At City University London, it works out at women being paid around £12,000 less than men on average, and at King's College it's £10,000. So
that's unacceptable, isn't it? I mean, you've named and shamed the institutions in this piece. You maybe shouldn't read them all out. You can go along to timeshighereducation.co.uk and see all those figures. But I know John Gill, the editor's word, did written a particularly strongly worded editorial on it this week.
Fantastically.
Yeah, it's something we all know about, and it's very frustrating that we continue to write about it, because it should have been wiped out, shouldn't it?
Well, I mean, they're making steps in the right direction, it seems. And of course, this will slightly reflect some of the subject mixes, I suppose, in that the sciences, which tend to pay a bit more, I'd imagine, given the research money available, they tend to be dominated by men. And also, only about one in five professors are women. So that sort of that will play a part, but you know, it does seem like, you know, 40 years after equal pay legislation was passed and all these recent initiatives like Athena Swan, the gender equality mark, and, you know, all sorts of initiatives, it seems to be that the pay gap's still there in one of the most sort of enlightened sectors of the country, you could say, higher education, where everyone is supposedly based, you know, judged on the merits of their work.
Mm-hmm. That's one angle, of course, of this story, which we rightly focus on across the front splash. It's a pretty thorough piece of work, though. As I said at the top of the podcast, it covers around 11 pages of analysis tables. You'll be able to find out about how your institution's performing in this sort of area. So what are some of the other headlines coming out of that? I mean, we typically look at things like highest earners at institutions, things like grace and favour accommodation, and these are things that have come out again.
Yeah, this is the annual pay survey focusing on vice-chancellors that we do every year. And, you know, some of the figures are quite amazing, like Nottingham Trent there, vice-chancellor who's just retired. He took home £623,000 in his final year. And I've looked at some of the sort of the transparency about how these bonuses are awarded, and it does seem to me that quite a few universities have been sort of giving these sort of quite large one-off payments when vice chancellors retire, and you know, that's, you know, they could say, well, that's recognition for all the work they've done, but it does bump up the figures. And when universities are desperately trying to show that, you know, their value for money and that they're making savings and efficiencies all over the place, just to sort of gift this money to people does seem rather extravagant.
Mm. Not to mention squeezing their researchers for every bit of research income they can get.
Interesting stuff. And another thing I think you said you wanted to touch on was the political context in which this feature comes out. This year is obviously an election year, so you know, it's quite a different setting to what we've had in previous years.
Exactly. I mean, there's going to be a spending review after the election, and it's a very easy narrative to say, well, you know, vice chancellors have awarded themselves, you know, large bonuses again this year. There's obviously a lot of slack in the system, and we're going to demand savings, and that is the context in which universities will be operating. And several politicians have mentioned that, and it just does seem, at a time when you're trying to prove value for money, to have a 3.3% pay increase overall is rather unwise, given that the pay for the rank and file staff was quite restricted this year.
And that 3.3, sorry, is among VCs?
The average among VCs.
Interesting. Well, as I said, we could talk about this for an hour. There's more statistics to get your teeth stuck into in the magazine. You'll find it online too, of course. All our coverage is there as well. But moving on to another topic that gives us no end of discussion points, the Research Excellence Framework. We've got several stories this week, most interestingly perhaps about the cost of the exercise, in particular the cost to institutions of articulating their impact. Paul?
Yes, here we are, money again, and another one that politicians might take a look at. Obviously, you know, it's an old story that the REF or the RAE, as it was, is quite an expensive exercise, but it seems to have got even more expensive with impact. Obviously, there were various changes brought in with the REF to try and make it cheaper. But the impact element that's obviously the new bit seems to be particularly expensive. It was announced last week by Rand Europe, who've looked into this, that their estimate of how much it costs universities to sort of prepare all their impact case studies and all the rest of it was £55 million. Arguably it is. We'll come to that perhaps in a minute. But, I mean, it compares to the estimate of the entire cost of the last RAE, which was officially £47 million. Now, a lot of people think that was an underestimate, but nevertheless, that's the figure. Rand have sort of fiddled about with it to take account of inflation and the fact that it didn't cover Scottish institutions. So they've sort of re-estimated that at £66 million. So that would put the entire cost of the exercise at £121 million, if you assume that the other bits cost about the same as they have this time as they did last time. So £121 million, you know, is that a lot? Well, it is a lot, but then Rand have also worked out that it's only 1.4% of the total amount of QR money that will be distributed on the basis of the REF over the next 6 years. That assumes Heffy has a flat cash settlement in the spending review, of course, which it may well not. But anyway, it's pretty low transactional cost. By comparison, the Research Council's estimated transaction cost there of 10%. So 10% of the funding that goes to Research Councils is just sort of lost in the cost of actually distributing the money. So looked at it in that way, it could be seen as a snip.
On page 8 for all that assessment. Also on page 8, there's a second REF story, Paul. This one about a REF that might be based purely on metrics.
Yes, I mean, this again brings us back to money in a way, because I think the major reason people are talking about using metrics instead of peer review is that it would be cheaper and, of course, easier. The two obviously go together, because these costs are calculated basically man hours, the sort of indicative costs. Obviously, Hefke, at the behest of David Willetts last year, commissioned this independent review as to whether metrics could play a greater role in research and assessment generally. Now, that report hasn't been released yet. It's not until July. But there's the chair of the review, James Wilston, at the same event, presented sort of interim findings specifically on the ref. And their conclusion is basically that it's sort of steady as she goes. They don't think metrics, as they are at the moment, could play a bigger role in the ref, at least not in the outputs and impact section. They think there's potentially a bigger role for them in environment, which everybody seems to think needs a bit of an overhaul. But they're certainly not proposing a big transition as of the kind that Gordon Brown envisaged a few years ago.
Indeed. Well, all that plus a third ref story headlined "Grotesque Flow of QR to Minnows Could Sink Ref Scholar Warns," all covered in this week's news section. I'll leave that one hanging. You can read it online or in the magazine. Moving on, thanks, Paul, to our books section. Karen, you've not been with us for a few weeks, but that doesn't mean that you haven't been making podcasts. There's one we should flag up straight away, which was your interview last week with Tommy Dickinson, lecturer in nursing at the University of Manchester.
Did a fantastic set of research talking to psychiatric nurses and their patients from the era in which it was thought that gay men could be cured via various extremely unpleasant, distressing things that you could characterize as torture. And many people have. Dickinson spoke to a lot of nurses, some of them nonogenarians, about their experience, some of them themselves gay, some who resisted what they were told to do, others who went along with it. And he also spoke to some of the men who had been through this process. I think it's fair to say that there was not a rigorous look at the evidence base for this work. Tommy is himself a nurse as well as an academic and has worked in psychiatric nursing. So it was interesting to hear him talking about the rapport he established with people who might have felt anxious about talking about what they had done, which in retrospect most of them agreed, I think all of them agreed, was probably not such a great idea.
Well, I've listened to it. It's a fascinating discussion. You'll find it on the podcast page on the site. And as well, it is quite graphic in parts, the discussion that you have, but I think it's an important conversation, and it goes along obviously with the book review that was his book was the book of the week last week as well, and you'll find that there too.
That's right, and an outgrowth of doctoral work. A lot of people feel that, you know, first monographs by academics that grow out of doctoral study are not much fun to read. They're not the big book of aimed at the popular reader of people's later careers, but I think this is a testimony to how important a lot of those works can be. Only a shame that so many of them are published at such high prices. A lot of academic publishers, if you want to buy a book like that, it will cost you the best part of £70 or £80, and that obviously has a huge impact on how many people will access it. Mm-hmm. And I also spoke to Fields Medal winner Cedric Villani in a podcast a few weeks ago, the stylish and famous French academic. And this week, another French academic in our Book of the Week, Annie Cohen-Solal, is in the Book of the Week slot for her book Mark Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. This is part of Yale's Jewish Lives series, and it looks at the young man, Marcus Rotkevich, who would later become Mark Rothko. He won a scholarship to Yale University in 1921 at a time when Yale's authorities were expressing great disquiet at the high number of Jewish students there, as Cohen-Solal's archival work points out. Cohen-Solal is an interesting and as well as eminent scholar. She is probably the first genuine 68ard I have interviewed. She was part of the Mouvement du 22 Mars with Danny Cohn-Bendit. And she talked about how she and her fellow students thought it was outrageous that the Gaullist government ignored her generation, the post-war baby boomers. They were sent to ugly places in ugly bidonville, in a society of older people with no interest in youthful energies, and everything that should have been encouraged was forbidden: creativity, freedom, imagination. She's gone on to work in institutions in France, Germany, Israel, and the US, and says that she found the German institutions most interesting for their cooperative work environment between academics, staff, and students. Also this week, we have a review of Irvin Yalom's latest book. He is the psychotherapist and academic who's known for a book, Love's Executioner, which tells tales similarly to, I suppose, Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Our reviewer thinks, our reviewer Janet Sayers at the University of Kent thinks this may not be quite the follow-up everyone was hoping for, but we do find out that when your psychoanalyst asks you to say what you really think, you should probably say you really think you're paying him too much. You might get a discount. Also this week, we cover John Tierman's book, The Dream Chasers, Immigration and the American Backlash, addressing the political turmoil around the young people that were to have been allowed to stay in the U.S. under the Dream Act and the right-wing political movement against allowing that to happen. Also this week, Jane Shaw, the author of Octavia, Daughter of God, and Dean for Religious Life at Stanford University, has covered a book on Veronica Lukin, who was a visionary Roman Catholic in the U.S. in the late 60s, who attracted huge crowds and a huge following. The Vatican weren't quite so keen on her, but then again she gave her own back because she did claim that Pope Paul VI had been replaced by a communist imposter. And two great books on higher education this week. One, Reflective Teaching in Higher Education. This is a book co-authored by Paul Ashwin and a number of colleagues. And our reviewer, Sandra Leighton Gray, has nothing but commendation for it. She points out that she qualified as a teacher in the early 1990s and has been teaching ever since, but she found plenty in there to benefit from and points out, of course, that teaching has always been part of the academy going back to the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who've heard about Arizona State University and their president, Michael Crow, who has been shaking things up or serving as a harbinger of doom to come, depending on your view, his book, Designing the New American University, written with William Dabars, sets out the vision of Arizona State. There are academics who have said that it's terrifying, dystopian, and indistinguishable from Amazon. Ferdinand von Pronsinski, VC of Robert Gordon University, reviews it and suggests that you might want to look at it and make up your own mind.
Very good, thank you. There's an interview actually in the THE with Michael Crow from a few months ago that you'll find, well, it's probably actually, time flies, doesn't it? It's probably about 6 months to a year ago now, but it's still in there. Makes interesting reading, I assure you. Just search for it on the site. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on any of those stories that we've just discussed, you can do so at our website or on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. Just search for Times Higher Education. That's all for this week's Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.